Genesis 42, 1 through 38. It says, when Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you look at one another? And he said, behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die. So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. Where do you come from? He said. They said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them, and he said to them, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land. They said to him, no, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies. He said to them, no, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see. And they said, we, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. But Joseph said to them, it is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. Now on the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, my money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack. At this, their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? When they came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man, the lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, we are honest men. We have never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. Then the man, the lord of the land, said to us, by this I shall know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me, and take grain for the famine of your households, and go your way. Bring your youngest brother to me, then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land. As they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more. And now you would take Benjamin? All this has come against me. Then Reuben said to his father, kill my two sons if I don't bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. But he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. Now, if you remember, when we left off, the famine that God had prophesied through Pharaoh's dreams was in full swing, to the point that the famine had spread to all the surrounding area, not just Egypt. And as we've seen, where we were last week, God is accomplishing his plan to reveal himself to specific people and to the world. Joseph, Potiphar, Pharaoh. Now we see him work some more with the people or the nation of Israel. They're small at this time. Jacob, Israel, hears of the fact that there's food during this famine that's available to purchase in Egypt. And we have the wisdom of hindsight. We have the privilege of being able to look back on this story. But you got to keep in mind that even though Jacob is depressed because of his life circumstances, especially in his mind, the death of his favorite son, Joseph, God is at work to save him and his family from starvation, along with the people of Egypt and the world. But God is also accomplishing this big plan through the son that Jacob believes is dead. We got to let this sink in for a minute. If you're in Jacob's situation, he's convinced already that Joseph is dead and long dead. And now everything's falling apart. There's no food. This episode's happening that we're going to dive into tonight, where his brothers go to get food, and this person in Egypt says, well, I won't believe that you're not spies until you bring this young brother that you say you have. All this is happening, and in the midst of it, Jacob is convinced that God's not there. Yet, because of hindsight, we can look at it and say, actually, God's working this all out, and actually, it's going to end up even better than you would have imagined, because that same son that you think is dead is the one that God's going to use to rescue you. So, when we're in the midst of our trials, we too cannot have the blessing of hindsight, but we can have the blessing of knowing who God is. There used to be a song back in the 80s. Remember the song, Christian song, when you can't trace his hand, trust his heart. And that's what I want to talk to you a little bit about as we kind of move into looking at this story, and then next week really start getting into Jacob's life himself and his attitude. And we'll get into it a little bit tonight as well. The issue is whether or not we're going to hold on to the truth of God's word and his promises, or hold on to how we feel in the dark. I don't know why it is. I have some ideas. But I don't know fully why it is. But we have a tendency, when we're in those times of trial, to actually enjoy holding on to the bad feelings. You ever notice some people like being the victim? Playing the victim? There are some people that really don't want to come out of those times. For some reason, it gives us some sense of control when we feel bad and everything's awful. But God, in those instances, is wanting us to hold on to, by faith, who he is. Not to make our decisions by what man's eye sees. And don't make those decisions by how you feel, but by what God has said and who he is. Go to Romans chapter 8. Go to Romans chapter 8. I'm going to remind you of verses 31 through 39. Now, in Romans chapter 8, starting in verse 31... Paul says, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Who's going to bring any charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who's to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died, and more than that, who was raised and is at the right hand of God, who indeed is interceding for us. Now, before we go any further, we got to let this sink in. Some of you might not know the depth of what Paul just laid out. He says, you got to understand that God is for you. He's just said, you know, what shall we say to these things? He's just finished saying that those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he's glorified. He's going to get into how nothing's going to separate us from the love of God, how God takes all things and causes them to work for good, he's just said in verse 28. And he says, who's going to condemn you? It's not God. Actually, if you remember John chapter 5, verse 22, Jesus said this. He said, the Father judges no one. He's handed all judgment over to the Son. So if the one who makes the final decision on whether or not we're in heaven or whether or not we're in hell, whether we're forgiven or not forgiven, is Jesus, and he's the one who died for us, he's the one who saved us, he's the one who's given us his spirit, he's the one who's interceding for us, who can be against you? It ain't God, but a lot of us think he is. A lot of us, when he puts us through times of discipline, and by the way, the root word of discipline is disciple. And what's a disciple? A learner. It's being taught, someone being taught, someone being shaped and trained. And when we're going through God's discipline, we have a tendency to think that God is against us. And I want to challenge you tonight that when you're in the midst of that trial where you don't have the privilege of hindsight, you do have the privilege of knowing who it is that's orchestrating your situation. And you need to hold on to that in hope, in confidence, and boldness. Who's going to condemn you? The one who's going to do the condemning has already died for you, and he's interceding on your behalf. Look at verse 35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for his sake, we are being killed all the day long. We're going to go through trials. That's a part of being his child. We're regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm sure, Paul says, that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, and in case you look for a loophole, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. So when you're in the midst of that time where it seems like he's being harsh, we're going to look at that in a little bit, because we're going to wrestle a little bit tonight with the fact that why was Joseph so harsh to his brothers? We're going to get into that. It's going to help us understand how God is when he's seemingly harsh at times. But when you're in the middle of one of those times where you feel like God is being harsh and God is not there, or God doesn't care, or he's against you, or he doesn't understand how you feel, why is this taking so long? He is wanting you to hold on to what he's already said and what he's already proven. He's for you. For years, I have heard people say, nothing good ever happens to me. And I, inside, the prophet in me has to be real careful because I want to just speak. But a lot of times I think to myself, what did you just say about Jesus? If you're a Christian, nothing good ever happens to you. What did you just say about your salvation? Go to Romans chapter 8. Look at verse 28. I referenced it, but I want you to read it. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. By the way, I'm going to ask you this question. Do you know it? Don't be quick to answer, because we know it on paper. Whether we know it in reality will be proven through the trial. In Hebrews, we can look at it later on, Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. The Hebrew writer talks about being free from the love of money. For he, God, has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Therefore, we can confidently say, what can man do to me? In the midst of your trial, whatever it is, you have to stop looking at the circumstances, stop looking at how it could be fixed humanly, and hold on to, not knowing how God's going to do it, hold on to who God is when you can't trace his hand, trust his heart. Jesus was forsaken by God so that we would never be forsaken by God. You ever thought about that? So let's add another person to the list of people that God's working on in this story with Joseph and Potiphar and Pharaoh and all that. Do you know who it is? It's Jacob. It's Jacob. And God's been already been working on Jacob, if you remember from our study in Genesis, but he's not done. By the way, this list of people that God's working on includes the whole world. But not only is God working on Israel as a people, God is working on Jacob himself. I don't know if you caught this or not, but Jacob has become depressed and fearful because of the losses in his life. He's lost his favorite son, Joseph. His wife, Rachel, has died at this point. He's getting older. Have you ever noticed that as we get older, We get more fearful. By the way, the Bible even talks about that. If you go back and read Ecclesiastes chapter 12, when Solomon writes about, you know, fear God and get to know him while you're young, because there's going to come a day when you're older, and it describes old age in a very interesting and powerful way. It talks about how when a grasshopper dragged itself along, and some of us walk like this now, and it talks about how desires no longer stirred, and grinders cease, and your teeth get a little bit less, and you wake up at the sound of birds, yet all their sounds grow faint. But it also talks about being afraid. And as we get older, I've always been kind of a happy-go-lucky, bold, fun-loving, like to laugh, like to have fun. I used to do some crazy stuff. I remember a few times when our kids would see one of their cousins named Corey do some crazy things. And they'd come back and they'd talk. They'd say, "Corey's crazy." And Becky would say to them, "Your dad was worse." And they're like, "No way. Dad was never like that." Oh, some of you remember those years. Cindy's back there nodding her head. But as I've gotten older, I've become more fearful, more worried, more anxious. Go to Genesis 42. Look at verse 4 and look at verse 36 and 38. Look at how Jacob is talking now. Genesis 42, verse 4. Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Look at verse 36 of Genesis 42. Jacob, their father, said to them, "You've bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more," because at this point Simeon's being held captive in Egypt. "And now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me." Look at verse 38. "But he said, 'My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he's the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you're to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol.'" Does this sound like a bold, confident man who's grown in his walk with the Lord and passing on wisdom to the people beneath him? No, as he's gotten older, he's become fearful and depressed and discouraged. I touched on this last week, but I want you to see it. Go with me to Ruth chapter 1. Naomi got this way too. Go to Ruth chapter 1. If you're not quite sure where Ruth is, it's an easy way I've learned to remember it, is Joshua judges Ruth. I don't know what Ruth did that made Joshua judge her, but Joshua judges Ruth. That'll help you find it. Ruth chapter 1, look at verses 12 and 13. "Turn back, my daughters, go your way." This is what Naomi says. "For I am too old to have a husband. If I should say, 'I have hope,' even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they're grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Look at verses 19 through 21. "So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem." This is Naomi and Ruth. "And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?' She said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" In both instances, Jacob and Naomi do not lose their faith in God. They know he exists and they still believe in him. They just think he's against them and not for them. And when we feel this way, we shrink into the background and live fearful, defeated lives. Folks, I'm just going to stay here for a little bit because I feel like God wants us to hear it. I don't know who here needs to hear this. I don't know who all listening online needs to hear this. I know myself. I have to be careful myself to be reminded in the renewal of my mind that as I get older and my tendencies to become more fearful and less a man of faith, I need to be reminded of Joshua and Caleb and those who are willing as they get older to be even more bold and trust the Lord That's not a very natural thing in our flesh, and I want to help you understand that that is what is going to happen in your flesh as you get older. It's natural, but it's not good. It's natural, but it's not right. But we're not natural people because of Christ in us. We're supernatural. And actually, one of the greatest ways for God to demonstrate his reality in us and through us is for us to be bold, confident, faithful, trusting, hopeful people who believe in God. Remember we talked about how Joseph, his dreams weren't coming true? Yet when the two guys in the prison shared with him his dreams, he didn't say, "Don't ask me, my dreams didn't come true either." He said, "Don't dreams interpretation belong to God? Tell me your dreams." And I want to challenge myself, you all are welcome to listen at the same time, I want us to move into a greater boldness for God as we get older, not shrinking into despair and self-pity. I have, those of you online may not know this person, some of you in this room will, I have the privilege of preaching my buddy Tony Kessinger's service this coming Saturday at 10 at First Baptist Melbourne. And a lot of you know what an amazing man he was, yet in the midst of all the gifts that God had given him and the abilities and spiritual power that he was, for the last 20 years of his life, he had to struggle with Parkinson's disease as his body continued to deteriorate. But if you know Tony, he didn't quit. He kept going. He kept being used by God in any way, in every way. And I'm going to share some things about him that some of you maybe never knew on Saturday. And I want to be someone that doesn't become more fearful. Are there times that it looks like God's not for us? It may feel that way. It may look that way. But are you going to hold on to the pity, the victimhood, if you will? Or are you going to hold on to who he is and what he's already proven through Jesus Christ? By the way, when we shrink into the background and live fearful and defeated lives, that's not how God has designed for us to respond to trials. Go to James chapter 1. James chapter 1, look at verses 2 through 4. Feel bad for yourself, brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. Is that what it says? No. Complain about it, my brothers, when you meet trials. No, that's not what it says. Look at what it says. Let's be honest. That's crazy. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you, there's that no word again, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Oh, that when the next trial comes, and it will come, would we become people who say, look at what God's going to do through this. I remember years ago when I was in seminary and finances were at its lowest point I'd ever had as a single. I was engaged to Becky, but I was a single man, and my bills were such and my finances were such that I actually went into the financial aid office at the New Orleans Seminary to beg for them to forgive some loans, to pay off a debt that I had. I told you, I was a little bold and a little crazy when I was young. I went into the financial aid office and I read Matthew 18 to the financial aid guy where the master forgave the great debt. And the man says, well, it was a good try. And then as he looked at my financial situation, he said, here's my advice to you. He said, I'm going to recommend that you drop out of school. I'm going to recommend that you go get a full-time job. I'm going to recommend you go get your bills paid off by working this full-time job and then come back and finish seminary when you've been able to catch up on your debts. I sat there and just didn't have a peace about it, and I told him, I don't think that's what God wants me to do. He said, well, then you need to do me a favor. And I said, what's that? He said, when God does this miracle, and it's going to take a miracle for you to get this squared away. He goes, I want you to come back and tell me because I want to see this miracle. And within 3 days, God had miraculously provided financially everything I needed, and all the bills and the debts were paid by God within 3 days. And I was able, less than a week later, to go back to his office and say, I'm covered. But I loved what he said. When God does this, I want you to come back and tell me. He believed it. He said, when God does this. He didn't say if God does this. He said, when God does this, you come back and tell me because I want to see God do this miracle. Oh, that we would look at our situation and say, I can't wait to see what God's going to do in this one. Go to Hebrews chapter 10. Look at verses 32 through 39. By the way, that wasn't the only time that God put us through one of those financial situations, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. We've all been there over and over and over. Hebrews 10, 32 through 39, but recall the former days when after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with suffering, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we're not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. The Hebrew writer is encouraging these Christians. They've been through trials. Now the trials are getting harder, and some are thinking about just, you know what, it's just too hard fighting it anymore, and they just want to shrink back. And he says, that's not who we are. You, when you were younger, when a few years back, you were bold in the midst of the trial, and you weren't worried about you were going to lose, and you were strong for the Lord. Don't, as you get older, lose that. God's working on Jacob right now. Oh, he's working on Joseph and his brothers and Potiphar and Pharaoh and Egypt and all the people around, but he's working on individuals in the midst of what he's doing. So Jacob's sons, all except Benjamin, go down to Egypt to buy grain. And when we get there, they're met by the governor of the land, and they don't realize it's their brother Joseph. And without realizing that Joseph is the governor, they fulfill the dream that God gave Joseph back in chapter 37. Go back to Genesis 37, look at verses 5 through 8, and then we're going to read a couple of things in chapter 42 and 43. Go to Genesis 37, verses 5 through 8. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So 20 years later, you know what these guys do? The same ones that said, we ain't never bowing down to you. Go to chapter 42, look at verse 6. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Look at verses, chapter 43, look at verses 26 and 28. Genesis 43, 26 and 28. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present that they had with them and bowed down to him to the ground. Look at verse 28. They said, your servant, our father, is well. He's still alive. And they bowed their heads and they prostrated themselves. It took a while, but everything God had said was going to happen did. Their brothers bowed down to him. Now, they don't know that he's Joseph. He looks Egyptian now. He's speaking Egyptian. They're using an interpreter. And what Joseph does next may seem surprising, but But as we're going to see, not just in this chapter, but in the chapters to come, there's a method behind Joseph's seeming harshness. Joseph treats them harshly and accuses them of being spies. And they honestly say, no, we're not spies. We're all brothers, and we're a bunch of 12 brothers, and our father's still alive, and there's a brother still home, and one's dead. And over and over and over, through the interpreter, Joseph says, no, you're spies. And then he throws them all in prison for 3 days. I'm just going to keep you here until the youngest one you say. That's how we'll know whether or not you're real. We're going to have the youngest one come. But then after 3 days, he says, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep one. And he chose Simeon. The rest of you go back, and I want you to go get your brother, and you come back. That's the way I'll know that you're not spies. Does he know who they are? Of course he knows who they are. But as you're going to see, and it'll become much, much, much more clear as we go further along, he's testing their hearts to see if there is true repentance and sorrow for their sin towards him. We're going to see this, like I said, a few more times in different ways as the story unfolds. But I want you to notice how Joseph is pretending to be an Egyptian. Look at chapter 42, verses 14 through 17. Chapter 42, 14 through 17. But Joseph said to them, it's as I said to you, you're spies. By this you shall be tested, by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you're spies. And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. So here he is. He's saying, by the life of Pharaoh, instead of I swear to God, he says, by the life of Pharaoh. He's pretending to be an Egyptian. Look at chapter 43, verses 31 and 32. Then he washed his face and came out, and controlling himself, he said, serve the food. They served him by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that's an abomination to the Egyptians. So even at this point, later in the story we get to next week in chapter 43, he doesn't even eat with them because Egyptians don't eat with non-Egyptians. And then I thought about this. I'm like, Lord, what can we get out of this? Why is he pretending to be an Egyptian? And God took me to Luke chapter 24. I'm going to show you in Luke 24 that God sometimes appears to be someone he's not. Go to Luke 24, verses 13 through 16. Now, to catch you up with what's going on, Jesus has already died on the cross, been in the tomb, and now he's risen from the dead. This is the same day that he rose from the dead, that same evening, that Sunday night. Luke 24, look at verses 13 through 16. That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and they were talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And if you know the story, he acts like he's clueless. What are you guys talking about? We're talking about all the stuff that's happened in Israel. I mean, in Jerusalem these days. Well, tell me about it. I'm curious. Are you a stranger here? You don't even know what's going on. And then they tell the whole story. And he acts like he's not who he is. He doesn't say immediately, that's me. He says, well, guys, don't you understand the scriptures said all these things were going to happen? And he spends the rest of the talk acting like he's not Jesus, telling him about Jesus. I'm going to ask you a question. I already know the answer, but I want to have you think about it so it'll sink in. Are there times that God appears to you? It seems like he's acting in a way that contradicts who he is. Yes. There can be times that it appears to us that he's not everything he's promised. Why? Same reason. He's testing our faith. What did Jesus do on the road to Emmaus when he talked to them? What was what he used to get them lined up with who God is and what God was doing in that situation? Scriptures. He took them to the Word of God. I've said for years, there's a lot of Bible studies that are mentioned in the Bible. One of them's the one that Paul gave where it lasted 3 hours and the guy at Eutychus fell out the window because he fell asleep during it. I might not have wanted to sit through that one. But I would want to sit through this one that lasted in this 7 mile journey to Emmaus, where Jesus taught them from all the scriptures concerning himself. That would have been really cool. But all he did, even though he was right there, was point them back to his word. And folks, there's going to be times where you're going to be going, hello? Hello? Are you there? God, I'm calling out to you. And he's just going to keep sending you back to his word. I know what your word says, but it doesn't look like that. It doesn't feel like that. Yeah. But are you going to hold on to what I've said and who I've proven to be? Or are you going to hold on to what it looks like and how you feel? And folks, all of us have to wrestle with that. All of us, more than once in our life, are going to have that test. And Joseph pretends to be someone he's not, and he seems to be harsh, but actually, he's not being harsh. He's testing their true heart. You know why? Because, well, we'll get to that in just a second. Let me add one more thing, and then I'll get to the why. Joseph does bring their God into the picture with what he says next. We've already seen how he says twice, by the God of Pharaoh, or by Pharaoh. Go to Genesis 42, and look at what he says in verses 18 through 20, though. Very interesting. He's supposedly an Egyptian, but he says in verse 18, on the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and they shall not die. So what's interesting, he says, you know what? Instead of keeping you all here in custody, I'm going to let you all go back so your families can be fed. I'm going to just keep one because I fear God. He brings their God into the conversation now. That has to get the attention of these Hebrews that this Egyptian would say he fears God. All of a sudden now they move from by the life of Pharaoh to thinking about God. And he also reminds them by saying this that their God is watching them and he knows their words and their thoughts and their actions. And then Joseph hears them when they confess their sin against him and they talk with one another. Go to chapter 42, verses 21 through 24. After he says, I fear God, he's pretty much saying, your God's watching. Then they said to one another, verse 21 of chapter 42, they said to one another, in truth we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, didn't I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. Did y'all catch this? How many years has it been? At least 20? And the brothers, when this is happening, immediately realize where this is happening because of our sin against Joseph. This is happening because of what we did. And the scripture tells us that Joseph hears and he understands what they're saying. And actually, he has to turn away and weep. So I'm going to ask you a question. Why doesn't Joseph stop the game now? Why doesn't Joseph stop the game now? Any ideas? I'm sorry? Well, his brother's not there yet. That could be tied to it since he said, I won't believe until. But there's something deeper here. And we need to understand this, especially in the world in which we live today. There is a difference. Remember, he's testing their hearts. There's a difference between acknowledging wrong and having a change of heart. They're two different things. By the way, do you realize there's lots of people that know what they're doing is wrong, but they're not going to change? Go to Romans chapter 1. Look at verses 18 through 21 and then jump down to verses 28 through 32. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness, unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Jump over to chapter 1, verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, even though they knew him, they didn't want to acknowledge him. God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. There's a big difference between knowing what's right and wrong and having a change of heart. There's a big difference between acknowledging what you did was wrong and having an actual heart of repentance. They've acknowledged we shouldn't have done what we did. But does that mean they're repentant? Or are they more sorry that there's been consequences for their action, not a real change of heart? And that's what's going to be coming out, as you'll see. This testing of their hearts is going to continue. I'm not going to get into it just now, but next week when we get into chapter 43, you're going to see Joseph do some more things that just pushes those buttons. For example, when he feeds them, he lines them up in order of their age. And they're looking at each other like, how do they know this? And he has them serve them. But Benjamin, when he shows up, gets five times as much. Why? Well, we're going to deal with that next week. But let me just say this to you. God is shaping us. But he's wanting more than just to say, yeah, you're right, I was wrong. He's wanting a change of heart, where you don't just acknowledge that it's wrong, you actually are repentant. You turn away from it, not just saying, yeah, you're right, that wasn't a good thing to do, but then keep doing it. Joseph is testing their hearts. Joseph's going to put them, like I said, through some more tests to see if they're truly repentant for their sin. And one of the tests that he does in this story, in chapter 42, is to bless them even when they don't deserve to be blessed. Look at verses 25 through 28. Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed, and as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, "My money's been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack." And at this, their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" So keep in mind, this is another test. He actually blesses them when they don't deserve to be blessed. They're already starting to acknowledge their guilt and their sin, and on top of them starting to acknowledge their guilt and their sin, they're blessed, and all the money that they had brought with them to buy the grain, they get all the grain for free. Oh, but as you're going to see, they're passing the tests. Their hearts are changing. You're going to see that. Their hearts are changing because they didn't go, "Hey, guys, check it out. Isn't this cool? Let's not tell Dad." No. When they saw that their money was there, they were even more afraid. We don't deserve this. What's God doing? I'm going to ask you a question. How do you respond to God's blessings? How you respond to God's blessings will show your hearts just as much as, if not more, than how we respond to hardship. We've already talked about earlier today that the trials have come to test our faith, and we all hear trials, and we think suffering, hardship, loneliness, whatever. But do you realize that prosperity is a trial as well? It's actually a harder trial. It's a harder test. Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 24, you all know, but go ahead and turn there. I want you to see it. Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24. Listen to what Jesus says. In Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24, don't lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves don't break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye's healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye's bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. And then if then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and money. So how is this all connected? We understand the door, don't store for yourself treasures on earth because it could be lost in the market or someone could rob you or whatever. He says, store up your treasure in heaven where none of that stuff's going to happen. It'll accumulate and be fine. But then before he gets to you can't serve both God and money, Jesus says this stuff about the eye's the lamp of the body. And if your eye's good, your body's full of light. And if your eye's bad, there's darkness. In other words, what he's saying is this. He said, just like the eye is where you take in light or darkness, if your eye's not working good, it will affect your body. And in the same way, if you are focused on the wrong thing and looking at the wrong thing, it'll have a negative effect on you. Are you looking at your money? Or are you looking at the one who's in control of everything and the one who provides everything? If you're looking at him, he'll take care of you and you'll have peace and joy. If you're looking at your money, you're going to go up and down with your money. And it's going to have an effect on you. Go to Luke 16. Look at verses 10 through 13. Luke 16, starting in verse 10. Jesus said, one who's faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. And one who's dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If you've not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you to true riches? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. So there Jesus is again saying the same thing at the end as he did in Matthew 6, but here he says, look, if you're not faithful in a little bit, you won't be faithful with much. And on top of that, if you can't even be faithful to be handling unrighteous wealth, who's going to trust you with things that aren't your own? I mean, sorry, that couldn't be your own. Instead of when you've been given responsibility to handle stuff that isn't your own. Folks, and we've said this for years in this ministry, your attitude should be, it's just money. It's a tool. God's my provider. Yet we all have to be careful because it's one thing to have to trust God when you don't have anything. It's a harder thing to trust God when you have a bunch and God says, now I want you to give it away. Lord, I got no problem to trust you when I got nothing because if you don't provide, I don't have it. But when all of a sudden he blesses you with extra and then says, I want you to take this and do with it. Lord, I got to be honest with you. I've kind of been comfortable with that's been sitting in the bank. I felt pretty good. And God says, are you willing to give it away? That's going to show the real heart, which is a harder test. Trusting God when you have nothing or being willing to give it away when you have much. It's a harder test. It's a harder test to be blessed. Go to 1 Timothy 6. Look at verses 17 and 19. 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 through 19. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They're to do good, to be rich in good works, and to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. I'm just going to not spend too much more time there, but understand that prosperity is just as much of a trial as poverty, probably a harder one, and probably not probably. But let me also say this. They're being tested in how they respond to his blessing them. By the way, they're going to pass the test. They're going to pass the test. Look again at verse chapter 42. Look at verse 35. Chapter 42, verse 35. And they emptied their sacks. Behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And they, when their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. Chapter 43, look at verses 11 through 15. This is when they go back to Egypt. Then their father Israel said to them, "It must be so. If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the choice fruits of the land in your bags and carry a present down to the man, a little balm, a little honey, gum, myrrh, pistachio, nuts, and almonds. Take double the money with you. Carry back with you the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight." Did you catch that? Look at verse 15. So the men took this present, and they took double the money with them and Benjamin, and they arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. They were given the money back, and they didn't say, "Oh, cool." They were like, "Let's give it back. Let's go back and just make sure there wasn't a mistake here. And let's say, hey, look, we are honest people. This is the money we gave for our food, and somehow it ended up back in our sacks. Here it is, and more money for the next batch of grain." We're going to deal with this more next week as we look at chapter 43. But I want you to see, little by little, Joseph's brothers are passing the tests. Remember, God's not only working on Joseph's brothers, but on Joseph's father as well. By the end of this chapter, though, where we leave off tonight, Jacob is unwilling to let Benjamin go to Egypt to release Simeon from prison. Did you remember that last part? By him not being willing to let Benjamin go, he's willing to let his other son sit in prison. In verses 36 through 38, we're not going to read it. You remember at the end, he just said, "No, I'm not doing it." But I also want you to notice something, what he says, what Jacob says to his other sons. He's willing to leave Simeon in prison and unwilling to let Benjamin go because since Joseph is dead, Benjamin is the only one left. Did you catch that? Look again at verse 36 through 38. Jacob, their father, said to them, "You've bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more." He's considering him dead now. You're just going to leave him there? "Now you would take Benjamin, all this to come against me." Of course, Reuben says to his father, "Kill my two sons if I don't bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I'll bring him back to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he's the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol." How many other sons are standing there right then? Nine? And in front of these other nine, God, through Jacob's wrong response, pushes another button on these boys. You know why? What was their issue? Why did they sell their brother? They hated him because of their father's favoritism. And because of their father's favoritism, they despised Joseph. "We ain't gonna bow down to you. Let's sell him. Pretend he died." And now, their buttons are being pushed again. Jacob, in front of them, says, "Benjamin's the only one left. Now that Joseph's dead, Benjamin's the only one left." I'm going to ask you a question. Again, don't say this out loud, but I've been a pastor long enough to know a lot of people's backstories. Not supposed to happen. Do you have parents or grandparents that had favorites? and it pushed your buttons? Again, where are you going to look? Are you going to look at your situation? You going to be a pity party? Are you going to look to God, who said, look, I'll be the father to the fatherless. I'll be the husband to the widow. I'll be the one. I want to be your everything. I don't want to be an add-on to your life. I want to be the center of your life. Are you willing to, even though these people are wrong in what they do, wrong in what they say, are you willing to respond in such a way that it doesn't bother you? Because you know that I am your supply. I'm your source. I'm your joy. Again, what Jacob does here is wrong. But it's also being used to push their buttons again. Now, interestingly enough, Reuben offers his dad to kill his own two sons if he doesn't bring Benjamin back. Again, I don't know if he was sincere, because think about what he's really saying. You get to kill two of your own grandkids. What grandparent's going to say, yeah, that's a good deal? They might be quicker to say, I'll kill you before I kill my grandkids. So I don't know if Reuben was really offering or if he was just exasperated. But later on, when we get to chapter 43, Judah is going to offer his own self as a pledge for Benjamin. And Jacob, when we see next week, is going to relent. But he's not going to relent in faith. He's going to relent by just simply giving up control. He gets to a point where he says, I don't care. I just don't care. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I've tried to have control. I don't have control, and I'm just giving up. We're going to deal with that a lot next week. But as we close tonight, I'm going to ask you a question. How are you responding to God's test of your faith? Trials of suffering, loss of hope, prosperity. In what way is God, who knows you better than anybody else, pushing your buttons? You're going to see this over and over again. God's going to say, does it hurt here? Does it hurt here? Does it hurt here? Why are you doing that? Actually, because I love you, he says. And I know what's best for you. And I want you to be healed. And I don't want you to live your life holding on to these things, just getting by, getting to heaven because you know you're getting to heaven, having a faith in God yet thinking he's not good and he's against you. I don't want you to end up your life shrinking back in defeat and fear and depression. I want you to move forward in hope. I've come that you might have life and have it to the full, have it abundantly. These things I've said to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy would be complete. Folks, it's time that we allow the surgeon to continue and to finish his surgery in each of our lives. And I don't know your individual stories, but I can tell you this. I know God's been pushing your buttons. Are you going to let him bring healing? Are you going to let him finish what he started? Or are you just going to shrink and become, you haven't left the faith. You've just stopped being of any value to be used in the time you have left. We're supposed to be shining as lights in this world. How? By living in the midst of our trials in such a way that people say, your response is not natural. Why are you so happy? That response is not natural. Why were you willing to give that all away? Because I have a God who is for me. I love y'all. We'll see you next week.